Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, this is The Takeaway for Tuesday, October 3rd, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today.
I don't know if I have words to describe what we're going through and what these poor, unfortunate victims are going through. We're angry, we're grieving, we're confused, people are hurting.
That was Nevada Governor Brian Sandoval speaking on Monday and expressing the reactions held by millions of Americans after Sunday night's mass shooting at a Las Vegas country music festival. The violence marked the deadliest mass shooting in modern American history. According to officials, at least 59 people are now dead and over 520 injured by gunman Stephen Paddock. Yesterday, law enforcement officials confirmed that at least 23 guns were found in Paddock's hotel room in Las Vegas, along with hundreds of rounds of ammunition and more guns in his home outside of Las Vegas in Mesquite. Later in the day, before that information was released, reporters asked Clark County Sheriff Joe Lombardo whether the attack could have been prevented, and here's what he had to say.
This is an individual who was described as a lone wolf. I don't know how it could have been prevented if we didn't have any prior knowledge to this individual. It wasn't evident that he had weapons in his room. We have determined that there has been employees going to and fro from his room, and nothing nefarious was noticed.
That's the sheriff of Clark County, Joe Lombardo. Later on this hour, we'll hear from two people who were there in the crowd when the attack came at the Route 91 Harvest Festival. Now we have more details from Las Vegas. Clark County Fire Chief Greg Castle is here. Chief Castle, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome.
What's the state of recovery now? Are all of the injured people, as far as you know, counted and assessed? Do we have a full picture of the toll of this tragedy?
Well, we do as far as, you know, as the injured and wounded. Our hospitals are doing a wonderful job managing what they did. Hundreds and hundreds of patients, many of whom are critically wounded. Those are continuing to hopefully heal, and hopefully our 59 does not go up.
Yeah. Chief, there were thousands and thousands of people there in a panic as shots rang out. Of course, your firefighters go in the opposite direction along with police officers. They often go towards the sound of gunfire because it's part of the job. How are your people holding up now that a couple of days have passed and maybe people have let their breath out a little bit?
Well, you know, this is going to be a significant event moving forward for our organization. Many of the people that were there I've known for upwards of 20 to 30 years. And yesterday morning, speaking to them, seeing them at the scene that night, definitely a different tone, both visually and in their voices. So we've got our work cut out for us in the next, you know, weeks, months, years to make sure that our people mentally wrap their hands around what happened and try to be as healthy as they can.
You say a different tone, and look, being an EMT or a first responder carries with it the experience of seeing some traumatic stuff. Shootings happen, not on this scale all the time. Certainly fires, and people can be hurt in fires, and that can be traumatic to experience as well. What's different here?
Well, the difference here is when you go to certain events, traffic accidents, shootings of a much smaller scale, the situation wraps up very quickly. There's not as much carnage. It's not spread. It's not as the volume of it is not as much. And the fact that, you know, from the firefighter side of the responses, we just barely started wearing ballistic gear and helmets about 4 years ago. We were nowhere even near the integrated phase of what we call rescue task forces, where police officers and firefighter are together in a cell going forward into hostile environments to make sure they can contact as many people as possible. So that is a change for us, you know, as a fire service industry. We're not used to being in those situations. So it's challenging, and we have to learn the good, the bad of all that went on that night. But I can say right now, from being there and seeing what was done and how it was organized and commanded by our wonderful battalion chiefs and from both City, Las Vegas, Clark County Fire, and Henderson Fire, very impressed with what they did. They, you know, under fire, literally, and they did a very good job.
Chief, I'm going to let you go because I know you're busy. Look, we heard from your colleague, Joe Lombardo, the chief of police, the sheriff from Clark County at the top, saying that he didn't think this attack could have been prevented. Do you agree with that?
I do. I do. You know, the mind of a madman is their own world, and whatever happens in that world of a madman, it's tough to predict. It's tough to pick up. I don't think there's any way this could have been prevented.
Greg Castle is the fire chief in Clark County, Las Vegas. Chief, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Sunday's mass shooting in Las Vegas has restarted a purely American ritual. Whether anything needs to change about how easy it is to buy guns and amass an arsenal in this country. Nevada has some of the most relaxed gun laws in the nation. According to the National Rifle Association, you don't need a permit to purchase or carry rifles, shotguns, or handguns in Nevada. There are no restrictions on the number of guns you can buy, and you can carry those guns out in the open. The state legislature, meanwhile, has debated gun control for years in Nevada. In 2016, a ballot measure passed requiring universal background checks for guns sold or transferred in the state, but that initiative stalled before ever going into effect. Nevada State Senator Tick Sagerbloom is a Democrat representing the 3rd District, which includes downtown in Las Vegas and an area right near the Mandalay Bay Hotel. Senator, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
What do we know now about how Stephen Paddock acquired his many firearms, about 20 in the hotel room and more in his home outside of Las Vegas?
Well, so far, everything seems to have been legal. They were purchased through lawful sellers, and I don't know how he got it up to the room, but apparently in many small suitcases and things, but they were somehow or other, he carried them up himself, I think.
Now, we've all watched the disturbing video of the attack, but it's what you hear that I want to ask you about. It sounds like rapid fire, automatic gunfire. It seems like Stephen Paddock modified weapons to make them automatic.
It seems like that. I don't think they know for sure. There's also, I was reading this morning, there are things you can do with guns to have them pull the trigger. So it would be like almost like an automatic, but we really don't know the answer to that yet. At least
let's talk about the law in Nevada, because you've been involved in this, of course. Current state law doesn't require any sort of background check or permits to carry rifles or shotguns. Is that right?
Correct.
And what about concealed carry or open carry of a handgun?
Open carry is fine. We do have a concealed weapons law.
So you were born in Nevada. This is your home. You represent parts of Las Vegas, of course. How easy is it to access, buy, amass weapons there?
Well, the purchase is not much different than other Western states. As far as if you go to a gun shop, you do get a background check. We have tried to tighten that up, do the gun show loophole and give it to other people. That bill we actually passed. The governor vetoed it. We also had a bill, an initiative that was passed last November. We would do the same thing, and the attorney general has refused to implement it. So the reality is it's a very political issue, very hot button issue in Nevada, and some of us, primarily the Democrats, have been fighting to get that done.
Tell me a little bit more about ballot initiative one from last November that you just mentioned. What exactly would it do?
It was going to require background checks for gun shows, when you couldn't just transfer a gun, give somebody a gun. If you gave somebody a gun, you'd have to do a background check. So it was a small step, but it's one of those necessary steps. The voters approved it, and yet it still hasn't been implemented. So I don't know what it impacted this incident, but the reality is all these changes are incremental, and we just have to keep pushing.
And the attorney general said what after the people of Nevada approved that ballot initiative?
He interpreted it to say that there was a conflict with federal law and he didn't have to do it.
Look, Senator, I mentioned at the top that we have a purely American ritual here. Sadly, every time there's a mass shooting event, the conversation starts again about gun control in America. And it seems like in a Western state like Nevada, where there are very few laws, it's a conversation that's not likely to necessarily go anywhere. I'm on the outside of Nevada, so I don't know. But what do you say?
Just the opposite. I think, we said we've been kind of the epicenter of this battle the last few years. And so I think this will re-energize the side that's trying to push for further controls. It is a hard battle. And being at the epicenter, you can see the power the NRA has. I mean, they are relentless and they don't stop at anything. And it's always we're taking guns out of the hands of lawful people, which we're not trying to do.
What does the NRA do in your state? Describe their political activity.
Primarily, they reach out to the gun owners, who are primarily white men, who they're working men. They should be Democrats, but if you try to take a gun out of their hand, then they become Republicans. And that's, if that's 1 or 2%, that can swing an election. So that's what they do. And we just have to keep explaining that we're not trying to take lawful guns, but we are trying to avoid tragedies like just occurred a couple of days ago.
So what's your intention here in terms of the new policy, Tick Sagerblum? Are you and your colleagues going to have another go at ballot question one? Are you going to try some new things in the legislature? What's next?
Frankly, we don't know. It's way too soon, but I think it's probably too late to get something on the ballot next fall. But the real question is going to be who the governor is. If it's a Democrat, then I think the legislature will be able to pass something and get it signed and implemented. The Attorney General is going to be a big part of that. So next year's election will be a really major election for Nevada and for the issue of gun safety.
Given the horror of this event at the Mandalay Bay Hotel, Senator, and the community dealing with the aftermath, do you have any sense of how Nevadans will react to a debate over guns now after the worst mass shooting in American history?
Well, I'm on the one side, so I can just tell you my side is he's energized. They still firmly believe in their position, and we believe we're on the right side of history. So we just have to keep fighting.
The Mandalay Bay Hotel is just across the freeway from your district there in Las Vegas. How are you holding up? What are your constituents saying to you there in the community that's been impacted by this?
It's obviously just we're still in grief, in shock, but we will recover, and we just have to move forward. We want people to come to Las Vegas and have a good time, but we want them to know that they'll be safe. We are a very resilient city, a very strong city, and very united. So hopefully we can take this lesson and move forward.
Senator Tick Sagerblum, it's a pleasure to have you. I'm sorry it's under circumstances like this.
Thank you.
Senator Tick Sagerblum represents the 3rd District in Nevada in the State Assembly. He's a Democrat. Yesterday, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders turned away questions about gun control.
There's a time and place for a political debate, but now is the time to unite as a country.
So we asked you, when do you think is the right time to talk about gun control? More than 1,000 of you responded.
My name is Maya, and I'm calling from Chicago. I disagree with Sanders. Right now is an especially relevant time to discuss gun control, but we should also be discussing it in an ongoing fashion to put pressure on the NRA and on the lawmakers to enact strict gun control in the U.S.
My name is Stephen Best. I'm calling from Wilton Manors, Florida. If the Congress couldn't do something about gun control after dozens of children were killed in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, what is significant about this horrible event?
I'm Shannon, calling from a tractor in rural Mays County, Oklahoma. Gun laws cannot be mandated at a national level. Chicago, Las Vegas, even Elizabeth, New Jersey, where I lived and raised 2 children for 20 years, don't have the same civil environment that we have in rural Oklahoma. I don't have local law enforcement branch to protect me and my family. We have to have our guns and our freedom to protect our homes.
This is Tracy from Statesboro, Georgia. The time to discuss gun control is never. Inalienable right. If you want to restrict gun ownership by millions of upstanding citizens over one lunatic, then you must feel the same way about the millions of peaceful Muslims practicing in spite of one radical terrorist. But that would be considered racist and hateful.
This is Linda calling from Robbinsville, New Jersey. I do not agree with Sanders. According to the GOP and NRA, there is no good time to discuss gun control. If not now, when? After the next mass shooting or the one after that? I wish I could offer a suggestion for change, but until Congress is out of the NRA's pocket, I have little hope of change. If Sandy Hook wasn't enough to change the hearts and minds of people and of Congress, why should we believe this will be?
Samantha Gerges from Louisville, Kentucky. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. I've needed my firearm. An arsenal, to some people, is 5 or 6 guns. I've got 7. So I think that gun control isn't the issue. Maybe more strenuous background checks, but even then, this guy didn't have a background. It really is up to the person who owns the gun, and that's it.
Your voices on violence and guns and the debate over guns in America, 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. You can always tweet us, @TheTakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by AliveCor, working to make heart monitoring simple, continuous, and digital. AliveCor's cardio devices deliver EKGs and detect atrial fibrillation right from the user's fingertips from anywhere. More at AliveCor.com.
A new term officially began at the Supreme Court yesterday on Monday, and justices are starting off big. The court hears oral arguments today in Gill versus Whitford. And this case could have a huge impact on how political parties exercise power all across the country. The justices are going to have to decide here just how far parties can go when they draw congressional districts to their advantage, including some voters and excluding others. And the outcome could alter how districts are drawn in every state in 2018 and for elections into the future. Emily Bazelon is staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. She's been following the case, which started in Wisconsin after the 2010 census.
The Republicans controlled both state houses and the governor's office in Wisconsin after the 2010 census, which meant that they got to draw the new maps to redistrict in the state assembly, in the state senate, and for the congressional delegation for the state. And they conducted a quite secretive process. They had a few aides huddled together in a room at a law firm, and they hired a political science professor to do some sophisticated computer modeling for them. The computer modeling was allowing the map makers to lean further and further toward distributing Republican voters in the way that would produce the most possible Republican seats. And so what you then see in the 2012 elections is that the Republicans win 60 of the 99 seats in the state assembly in Wisconsin with less than half of the vote.
How common is that? And is that type of secrecy likely to play a factor here?
Well, it demonstrates to the courts that there was an intent to gerrymander here, right? And what was happening was that none of the Democratic lawmakers were invited into this process. And so that suggests that the Republicans knew they were doing something that the Democrats were not going to go for, and also that the public might not like either.
Have Republicans ever acknowledged amongst themselves or in public, hey, we did a great job, look at the results in the elections?
Yes, they did talk about that in internal emails before the elections. They also could argue at the time that they had done nothing wrong, legally speaking, because the Supreme Court has never struck down a redistricting plan, a map, because of partisan gerrymandering.
Is the technology the difference here, the ability to carve out block by block, street by street, even house by house, according to partisan imperatives?
Yeah, the technology definitely makes a difference. It makes it really easy to kind of quickly visualize what the risk is if you imagine a lot of different electoral outcomes. And there's another really important factor that explains why partisan gerrymandering has become so effective. And that's that voters themselves have become more predictable in their behavior. So if you're a registered Democrat, you're much more likely to vote for Democrats than you were in the past. And Democrats have another problem, which Republicans like to point out, which is that Democratic voters increasingly live in concentrated urban areas. And if you live all clustered together among other Democrats, it's going to be easier to gerrymander you into a smaller number of districts.
So, Emily, what's the court actually being asked to decide here? I mean, drawing your own districts, as we said, is common. It's been going on for a long time. So what's the court really looking at here?
The court is looking at whether judges should be able to oversee these map-making processes. So there are other areas of law in which judges get involved in redistricting. We have the rule of one person, one vote. That provides for equal apportionment. So we have precedents here for courts getting involved in map-making. And we're not talking about throwing computers out of the process. But what the Supreme Court could say is that the judges can also use the same tools of the map-makers to assess whether gerrymandering has gone too far. And we've not had that kind of set of cases, that open door for that kind of legal intervention until this point. And that's why this feels like a big new thing.
Now, this kind of case has come in the orbit of the court before. And in 2004, Justice Anthony Kennedy said, you know, this is really hard for us to rule on because we can't come up with what he called a workable standard. How are we supposed to judge what's fair, what's not fair, what actually constitutes a gerrymander? Can they solve that here?
In the past, four conservatives on the court, not these particular four, all of them, but the conservatives have been very unwilling to consider partisan gerrymandering claims. They think the courts have no business here at all. The liberal moderates on the court have been much more receptive to the idea that courts should be involved, but haven't settled on one particular test or a way to approach this. And so what Kennedy said was, I don't see right now a way to do this, but I'm leaving the door open for somebody to show me one, to show me a workable standard. And a lot of political scientists got into the act. They came up with tests. They're saying to Justice Kennedy, we do have that workable standard now. And the question is whether he thinks they're right.
So how could a ruling here impact all the other states outside of Wisconsin?
You know, the court has lots of choices here. The court could say, okay, based on the kinds of tests that the political science folks, the experts have come up with, Wisconsin's map is really, really extreme gerrymandering. It's an outlier. We say that's not okay, but we're not going to give lower courts a whole lot of instructions about what other maps. They can go figure that out. And then the court would have opened the door to a lot of challenges in the lower courts to other kinds of maps. And then over time, you would see an area of law develop in which there are sort of more and more guidelines for states. One sort of underlying force here is, do you think the fate of American democracy is at stake? I mean, we are seeing fewer competitive congressional races across the country as gerrymandering gets more and more extreme. And this is true for both parties. And then the question becomes, well, are we moving into a future in which one party becomes entrenched in a particular state or region and then can't be toppled? Projections right now are that the Democrats, in order to retake the House, would have to win the national vote by as much as 7%, just to get like 51% in the House. And when you start seeing that kind of handicapping, it looks like something's wrong. And then you might be more receptive to the idea of courts playing a role. And the other thing worth mentioning in this whole area is that some states have nonpartisan or bipartisan commissions that draw their lines. And so they've taken it on themselves as states to kind of distance the map making from the political process. And that option exists for each state, no matter what the Supreme Court does here.
Emily Bazelon, staff writer for The New York Times Magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Several lawmakers, including prominent Republicans, filed an amicus brief urging justices to end extreme partisan gerrymandering. Senator Richard Lugar was one of those prominent Republicans. Lugar represented Indiana in the U.S. Senate from 1977 until 2013. And he says gerrymandering isn't new, but what happened in Wisconsin is new, and it's helping to erode democracy.
This is not a new phenomenon. It's just the precision with which it's now approached. And this made Wisconsin a very conspicuous extreme case.
I mean, you're really talking about the ability to drill down block by block, even house by house, to determine voting behavior and draw these districts in really irregular shapes that carve out some voters and keep other voters in another district.
That's my understanding. It's a remarkable phenomenon. And it wasn't until the maps that the Republicans had generated were made public that really the public as a whole, quite apart from Republicans and Democratic legislators, had some idea of what the mastery of all of this was.
So, Senator, what's the impact, though, of all this, especially from someone like you who sat in the legislature and watched partisanship grow? What's the effect on democracy and on elected officials' connection to their voters?
The most stark effect is a sense of unfairness. Unfairness as voters generally look at it, quite apart from people in public life, is grossly unfair, as a matter of fact. It's a situation, literally, if you can look at it from this standpoint, in which the legislators are selecting their voters, as opposed to the other way around, in which the voters select the legislators.
And if I'm a member of Congress, let's say, from a heavily gerrymandered district, I don't really need to worry too much about what voters across the spectrum in my district think, because if there are enough, let's say, Republicans, party ID, and I'm a Republican, I can sort of do whatever I want. I'll get reelected.
Well, you would not need to think about the election in terms of a Republican versus Democrat showdown. The situation then becomes really the election is fought in the primary, because it's very apparent that whoever is going to be in the Republican seat and has a gerrymandered district is going to be elected in a general election. but the competition will come in the primary. And this may, in fact, drive the effects to greater extremes. In other words, the legislature may become more extreme Republican and Democrat simultaneously.
So Senator Richard Lugar will get a decision on this case after several months. How would you like to see the court rule? What do you want them to say?
I'm hopeful the court will uphold the previous decision, which is being appealed by Republicans in the state of Wisconsin, as well as the National Republican Committee and various others. I believe that the case has been decided and is being appealed now will at least render gerrymandering not only a bad idea, but hopefully will offer opportunities for reform.
And what's at stake, in your view?
What's at stake is the confidence of American voters that professional politicians of either party, now armed with much better data, much greater precision, are not literally going to take the franchise away from them. That on the one hand, they believe that they have voted for something and they find out the results are reported entirely differently.
Former Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana served in the Senate as a Republican from 1977 until 2013. Senator Richard Lugar, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your questions.
I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for being with us here on The Takeaway today. We return now to the aftermath of Sunday's shooting in Las Vegas. For concertgoers who were there at the Route 91 Harvest Festival on Sunday night, the trauma of the attack hasn't faded.
When we heard the first shot, you know, it sounded like fireworks. Nobody, even everybody around us, of course, you know, the show kept going on. And then we heard the automatic gun start to go off and people started to run. And that's when I knew we need to get out of here.
Jen Salazar was in the crowd with her 14-year-old daughter. They drove to Las Vegas for the show with her parents from their hometown of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And Ruth Thompson was there, too. She was at the concert with her boyfriend visiting from Erie, Pennsylvania.
Unfortunately, I work in an area where hearing gunshots is not uncommon. I knew the first three shots. I knew it was a gun. And I thought it was just, you know, some idiots in the crowd, maybe, you know, who had gotten in a fight or something. And I grabbed his arm and I said, let's get in here. And that's when the automatic rifle started and you heard people screaming and, you know, just heard the bullets flying.
What did you do?
The suite had an outdoor balcony, which is where we were originally watching the show. There were eight of us that got into, it was like a small trailer, and literally bullets were flying over our head and ricocheting off the back wall. And, you know, lived there and literally prayed out loud.
Jen, do you remember what it was like trying to get out of the concert grounds, what you did with your daughter and how the two of you escaped?
We basically, we followed the crowd. So of course we didn't have a way out. I didn't know where to go. There was these two women that were running towards their truck and I begged them, please just, can you please get us out of here? And there was a girl and a guy in the back. I want to say late 20s, early 30s. The girl that was in the back of the truck, she was shot in the leg. I had looked back and she had her leg up and it was just full of blood. The guy, I couldn't see where he was shot. He was laying down. When we drove out, there was another guy that was their friend in the back and he started banging on the back door. As soon as we saw, there was a cop and an ambulance right on the side of the road and he started banging on the window and he said, stop, pull over, pull over, pull over. Which then we stopped and we pulled over. They got them out and took them to the ambulance. They were our angels. They got us out of there safe and sound. And they even took us to their home and gave us shelter until our parents were able to get us.
Ruth, once you got away from the grounds and you felt a little more safe, at least from bullets, what happened then? What was going through your mind?
Similar situation. We ran out a back parking lot and got on the literally on the freeway and started running. Same thing. I saw a decent car, started banging on the window and asking her to help us. And she did. She and her husband pulled over and put us in the back of their car and drove us to another hotel about 10 miles off the strip. So about 2 hours after the whole ordeal started, I was in probably what I considered the safest place at that point in her car. Mm.
Ruth, do you feel safe now back in Pennsylvania?
I feel safer, definitely being at home right now. I feel good about that. I guess I'm angry, and I'm not used to that feeling. I'm not an angry person. I'm not a bitter person, but you know, I'm angry that something that I love to do, something that I look forward to every year, I've been to that festival every year since they started, you know, has been taken away from me. I know I'll never want to be in that situation again. And I can't imagine, I have a daughter. I can't imagine being there with my daughter. So hats off to you for dealing with that.
Thank you. We have a concert coming up here in my hometown. I got my daughter tickets to Luke Bryan for her birthday, and she doesn't want to go anymore because of this.
No, I don't blame mm-hmm. her. And I can't, somebody asked me in the airport if I was going to come to the 1 year memorial of this. And I thought, no way in hell. I mean, I don't want to say that that's been taken away, but I'm sure you can appreciate this when people are saying, I'm reading on Facebook posts where people are saying, this isn't going to stop me from going to concerts. And I'm like, you weren't there, you know, like you didn't experience this, you know. Don't say what you would or wouldn't do because you weren't there. And
you don't know.
Yeah, so you can relate because you were there.
You can't let it stop you. And I go, I know, but you weren't hovering over your child trying to protect her from bullets. You don't know what that's like. So you can't tell me how to feel. You know, I completely get that. Exactly. I really do.
Jen, how is your daughter doing now?
She seems to be doing okay. She's still real shaken about it. I think she's still trying to comprehend it.
Most of us weren't there either, but I think we all are.
Yes. That was her first time to Vegas. She never wants to go back. She doesn't want to go to her concerts anymore. And we go to at least 4 concerts a year. And that's our thing, that, you know, that's what me and her did together. But now she's like, nope. And she's been looking forward. We were looking forward to this trip since May.
Well, Jen, it's so early after the attack. Have you been able to give any thought to what needs to happen to stop this from happening again?
You know, every time a mass shooting or something like this happens, you know, you think, well, if this law was tougher, maybe it could have prevented it. If this was in place, maybe it could have prevented it. So, like, and with this one right now, I'm just, it's a mix of emotions, a mix of thoughts just going through my head, like, what could have been done? But I don't have one specific thought about what could have been done to that could have prevented this. I really don't know.
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, I have a concealed carry permit. I have 2 guns in my car. I have a gun next to my bed. You know, I protect myself, and I'm all for being able to carry a weapon. But what I don't understand is why one person would need, I think it was 18 guns, and there were 18 of these automatic rifles in his house, and 22. I was staying at Mandalay Bay. I was on the 21st floor, so just that many floors above me was somebody with all this ammunition and all this artillery, and that doesn't make sense to me. You know, I have a gun that holds 2 bullets. I have a gun that holds 5 bullets. He wouldn't have been able to do the kind of damage that he did, you know, had he used a shotgun or, you know, God forbid, whatever weapon he was using to hurt. It wasn't the guns that hurt us. It was the idiot behind those guns that hurt us. It was the fact that he was able to buy those types of guns and buy that amount of ammunition. I think there's something wrong with that. And I don't know that I would have said that prior to experiencing it. But when you're hearing that, and I know she can attest to the fact that there was so many bullets, and to see the bullets awesome. Flying across the ground. I mean, it honestly, I kept saying to my boyfriend, I'm like, there's got to be more than one shooter. There's got to be, you know, where are they coming from? And the sound, I'm with her. Like, I will never get those sounds out of my head. Like, to hear that much ammunition, and knowing guns, I have guns. I shoot guns in my backyard. Like, hearing the amount of artillery, the amount of ammunition that he had, that's just, it's not right. None of us need that.
Jen Salazar, Ruth Thompson, you've both been through something really, really terrible. I'm glad that you're physically all right. I'm glad that your loved ones are physically all right. And I just want to say again how much I appreciate you and your courage joining us on the air to tell us about your experiences. It means a lot. Thanks so much.
Of course. You know,
thank you.
this story it needs to be heard.
Let's go to Cuba now, where on Friday, the U.S. State Department announced it's pulling most of its employees out of the U.S. Embassy in Havana. And today, 15 Cuban diplomats were expelled from the Cuban Embassy in Washington. This latest escalation in tensions all revolves around a mysterious illness which has impacted almost two dozen embassy workers and their families, with symptoms including dizziness and hearing loss. There's a suspicion that the odd symptoms could be caused by an attack with sonic weapons. Too low of a frequency to hear the sound, but enough to make a person sick. In a report out on Monday, the Associated Press revealed that some of the early victims were members of the U.S. intelligence community in Cuba. Josh Letterman is a foreign policy reporter for the Associated Press.
We know that these attacks started in November, right around the time of President Donald Trump's election, but it took a while for the U.S. to put it together. And in fact, while there were diplomats that were being affected, it was America's spies in Havana who figured out first that something was happening because they, too, were getting attacked.
Has anyone confirmed that sonic weapons are behind all of this?
Sonic weapons continue to be a key theory the U.S. is looking at, but there are symptoms that people have reported that don't really match up. For instance, brain injury. We have several diplomats and workers in Havana who have had mild traumatic brain injury, known to most people as concussions, as a result of this. And scientists tell us that audio waves are unlikely to be able to cause that kind of deep tissue damage within the brain.
What about the other symptoms that people have been suffering? Why do some experts suspect sonic attack here?
Well, some of them match up. Certainly, it's possible, as most people know, through really, really loud sound to cause hearing loss, for example, or ringing in the ears. Those are two of the other symptoms. And because of the way the inner ear works, it makes some sense that you would have other issues with balance, perhaps headaches or nausea as a result of sound waves. But other symptoms that people have reported, including cognition, visual issues, and others, don't really seem to line up.
What are U.S. officials making of the latest revelations by the AP that members of the U.S. intelligence community appear to have been specifically targeted here?
Well, the government is not commenting publicly whatsoever on our report. The State Department said we don't want to comment about it. So did the CIA. But several individuals who are familiar with the investigation tell us it is true that many of the victims, certainly not all of them, but some of them were members of the intelligence community who were working down there. Now, that's perhaps not surprising because all over the world, the U.S. and other countries post spies working under diplomatic cover to their embassies. So it makes some sense that spies would be among those hit.
What does all this mean for Americans' travel to and from the island, visa operations, and the other things that the State Department does?
The U.S. took a really dramatic step at the end of last week by issuing this travel warning, urging Americans to stay away from Cuba. Now, they said American tourists and travelers haven't been attacked, only government workers, but some of these attacks have happened in the same Havana hotels where you would probably stay if you went on an excursion to Havana for a few days. So that's a very significant step. It could have a really chilling effect on the travel industry down there. And the removal of about 60% of our American diplomats in Cuba means the embassy down there is no longer able to do the kinds of routine things they do, like process tens of thousands of visas every year for Cubans who want to enter the United States.
You know, Josh Letterman, you have to ask a question at a time like this when these types of physical symptoms are kind of mysterious. Have officials considered the possibility of mass hysteria here, that either there was no actual sonic attack or maybe there was one, but not all of the illnesses among Americans and even some Canadians were actually caused by sonic attack?
They have. That's certainly one theory. We're told that at least 21 Americans have been, quote, medically confirmed by the United States to have been affected by this. But we certainly know that as panic has started to spread among the tight-knit diplomatic community in Havana, and the U.S. has encouraged its workers to report anything suspicious, that there are cases that have been reported where officials don't feel that they can conclusively tie it to these attacks. That said, I've talked to very few people who think that this entire thing is some type of mass hysteria, because there are some victims who have really serious and permanent injuries that the doctors that are looking at them believe are tied specifically to these incidents.
Mysterious symptoms and mysterious injuries among American personnel in Havana, and the State Department is pulling most of its employees out of the U.S. Embassy there. Josh Letterman with the AP, thank you so much.
Thanks, Todd.
We get better with age, you know. I think if we weren't getting better, we'd hang it up.
Well, it started out down a dirty road.
Down Depot Street, wanna see my baby.
Well, she was an American girl.
Well, I love you, baby, don't you like that?
Oh, baby, don't it feel like heaven right now? Well, stand my ground, and I won't back down. Now I'm free, free for. Take me as I come, cause I can't stay long.
I've dedicated my entire life to this music, you know, from the age of 10.
Oh man, Tom Petty needs no introduction. Petty died yesterday in Los Angeles after suffering cardiac arrest. He was 66 years old. Tom Petty toured and performed with his band, the Heartbreakers, for more than four decades, and the singer and guitarist had just wrapped up a 40th anniversary tour that ended at the Hollywood Bowl last week. In December, Petty told Rolling Stone that it was probably the last big tour for him and his group. "I have a granddaughter now. I'd like to see as much as I can," he told Rolling Stone. John Schaefer is here. He's host of WNYC Soundcheck and New Sounds, in the studio with me. John, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Todd.
I mentioned that Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers just wrapped up a 40th anniversary tour. We heard all that music at the top. How much of a shock for you is this?
You know, he's been such a part of the musical landscape here for so long. I remember seeing the Heartbreakers on what was probably their first visit to New York City back in 1977 and thinking initially, well, you know, he's got this one hit song called Breakdown. And back then, you know, Breakdown had a lot of space in it, very spare use of guitars. It sounded of a piece with other songs of that era, like The Police, Roxanne, or Elvis Costello, Watching the Detectives. But then it quickly became clear that there was more to Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers than that. That, you know, there was something of the Heartland Americana sound, but even beyond that, listening to the montage that you played just a moment ago, Todd, it strikes me just how many of his songs are built on kind of classic rock and roll gestures, you know, classic chord progressions that he somehow found a way to do something original and distinctive with.
Well, let's get right into it, since you mentioned the way he used chord progression, the way he used an Americana sound. I love this song, American Girl. Let's start with this. John, this is the song, I mean, no matter where you heard it, when you were out, you're in a bar, you're at a club, people got off their bar stools for this, and everybody knew the words.
Yeah, and that was back in 1977 that we first heard this song. But also, Todd, think of what happened in 1991 when the late Jonathan Demme used this in an early pivotal scene in the film
Yes.
Silence of the Lambs. And
Yes.
just a whole nother generation with that image of the pretty girl driving down the highway, her hair blowing in the breeze. I mean, this became not just a great Tom Petty song, it was a great American song.
She couldn't help thinking that there was a little more life somewhere else. After all, it was a great big world.
Hey, I gotta play you, you know, John, what I think, at least what I always thought when I was a kid. Maybe the best rock and roll duet ever done in America.
So you had a little trouble in jail. Now you're keeping some demon down. Stop dragging my, stop dragging my, stop dragging my heart around.
I mean, once Tom Petty pulled Stevie Nicks
yeah,
onto the
yeah.
stage with him, it was over.
Well, I'm going to go one better, Todd, and go from a duet to a quintet, and that is the Traveling Wilburys, which was Tom Petty, George Harrison, Bob Dylan, Roy Orbison, and Jeff Lynne of ELO. I mean, the word supergroup is bandied around these days with far too little care. This was a true supergroup, and, you know, their first song, Handle With Care, is kind of a great example of five stellar musicians coming together to have some fun, making a song that was supposed to be the B-side of a George Harrison single, and it was just too good to leave that way.
Everybody's got somebody to lean on. Put your body.
John, Bob Dylan didn't even want to accept the Nobel Prize, but he spoke out yesterday for Tom Petty. He talked about him on Twitter and paid him some respect.
Well, you know, Petty was a kind of a classic American figure, in a sense, kind of similar to Bruce Springsteen, you know, working class roots, very obvious in the songwriting, and yet somehow kind of transcending that to become an everyman that we could all respond to musically. And, I think, Todd, not so much back to that first concert I saw back in 77 when I think of Tom Petty, I think of 2008 and the Super Bowl halftime show, when there was a lot of grumbling when Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were picked. You know, people saying, oh, come on, it's yet another sop to the boomers. You know, they're afraid of younger musicians after the whole Janet Jackson, Justin Timberlake wardrobe malfunction. And they came out and in 12 minutes raved through four of his greatest hits in what was a classic performance. I mean, it was, I hate to keep using that word, classic, but that is Tom Petty in a nutshell.
Well, John, we've been getting tons of responses on Facebook about Tom Petty, people writing to us all over the place. Oligarchy wrote on Facebook, I had a horrible college breakup in 1984. I purchased the Long After Dark album for the song You Got Lucky. John, that's a song for people who are brokenhearted all over the world, but we got lucky with Tom Petty.
We did. And for the MTV generation, don't forget Don't Come Around Here No More, one of the classic psychedelic Alice-themed videos of the MTV era. There's a whole generation of people who remember the top hat. And that was also classic Tom Petty.
That's right. And the White Rabbit and the Big Teacup. Tom Petty gone at 66. And John Schaefer, thanks for coming on with me and giving us just a brief reprise of the amazing career of Tom Petty and his Heartbreakers. John Schaefer of Soundcheck and New Sounds on WNYC.
Thank you, Todd.
I appreciate it.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy and print. Staples, it's pro time.
Thanks so much for listening and for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.